Okay, today is Thursday, December 27th, 2018. My name is Catherine Ringsmith. I'm the director of the NN Cannery History Project, and today I am interviewing Oren Siebert, founder of Penn Air, and we are here at the Alaska Heritage Aviation Museum in Anchorage, Alaska. So thank you, Oren, for taking the time to talk with me today.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Katie.
Well, let's first of all start and have you state your name and make sure that we have the proper spelling. Can you spell your name for us?
Yep. I'm Oren, O-R-I-N, Siebert, S-E-Y-B-E-R-T.
Okay, so let me just ask you, what is your professional title?
Right now I'm unemployed. But I was the president, CEO of Peninsula Airways, which became a DBA as Penn Air.
And can you describe to me where you are, where we are right now?
The museum?
Yep.
Well, first of all, I founded the airline in Pilot Point. I was brought to Pilot Point when I was 13 years old. My mother was a school teacher there. So I basically grew up in Pilot Point, Alaska, a little village on the south end of Bristol Bay. And then I started flying because this little village had about 60 people. Still to this day, it's about the same. Two of my children still live there. And as I became a teenager, I saw this beautiful country around the mountains and the rivers and the lakes. And the only way to get out to see all of that was by airplane. And I was fortunate to be in one of the Bristol Bay salmon fishery rivers. Ugashik River was the smallest of the five, but still it was a lot of activity there and a lot of money. I mean, a 16-year-old kid could make a couple thousand dollars in a month's fishing. That was amazing. So I decided to learn to fly.
So let me just, before we start talking about aviation, let's talk more about Pilot Point. Can you just explain where Pilot Point is in relationship to Anchorage, where we are now?
Pilot Point is 400 miles southwest of Anchorage. It's 80 miles from south of King Salmon, again on the Ugashik River.
And can you describe the village that you remember as a child?
Yeah, like I say, about between 60 and 80 people, permanent residents, mostly Aleut Native. And my mom was the teacher. And in those days, the government, the Alaska Native Service, staffed the schools, furnished the schools, and through the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And so they hired my mom, and we lived in Puget Sound during World War II. And after the war, mom decided to move to Alaska, and she was kind of adventurous, and she had the teaching back then. So anyway, so we got to Pilot Point. There was an old salmon cannery there. It was no longer operational, but it was a fish station.
Was it APA?
Alaska Packers Association. Because it was a nice run of fish, but the cannery had to shut down because it was too shallow. But they still wanted to catch the fish and process them, so there was a pretty active fishery every summer. And that's what we did. And in the winter time, we could go trapping, make a few extra bucks that way. But there was nothing there, but the cannery had a store, and there was a post office, and then there was the school, and that was it.
So how old were you when you moved
13.
There? 13 when you moved there.
Yeah, we lived there for 4 years.
And you went to school there, and were there other...
I went to the eighth grade, through the eighth grade. But my mom, it was just, there was no high schools in the villages. That was before the Molly Hoots decision. Mm-hmm. So his first 8 grades, my mom had anywhere from 15 to 20 students each year with a one-room classroom, 8 grades. So first 8 grades, one room, and she taught everybody. And I went there through the 8th grade.
And how many children were in the full class?
Between, it varied from year to year, between 15 and 20. Okay. She would have students.
And so you had some playmates.
Oh yeah, yeah. Yeah, I grew up with the Native kids, and we became good friends, and have been ever since.
So when did you decide to fly?
Well, probably one of the points was meeting Jay Hammond. That was the next year. I was 14 when Jay came flying. After he left the military service, he decided to come to Alaska. He was from back east, New England somewhere. And he found Bella in Clark's Point. She was from Clark's Point. Married her, and they settled in Naknek. But he had a job flying for the Fish and Wildlife Service. And so he would fly into Pilot Point. He didn't like for me to tell this part of the story, but his job was to hunt wolves. Mm-hmm. So, and he had Jimmy Drew as his gunner, and he would fly a Super Cub, and they would go and find wolves. There was a lot of wolves around Pilot Point in the Mother Goose Lake area. And he became friends with my mom and dad. So they invited him to stay with them, with us, in the schoolhouse. And we had the teacher's quarters as part of the schoolhouse, but there was an extra room. So Jay spent nights with us, quite a few, in the wintertime. And he was my hero and my idol.
And of course, you go on to be governor of Alaska.
Yes, and much more.
Yeah.
But anyway, so he was a part of the reason I decided to learn to fly.
So how old were you?
I would have been 14 that year.
14.
But then 15, I started. See, and of course, there's no high school again. So for me to go to the 9th grade, my mom had to send me out because I didn't qualify for any of the Native programs, like Mount Edgecombe or Chemawa. So she sent me to a military school in Kansas where I was born. And my grandparents still lived there. And so I spent 2 years in that military academy, and they had a flying program with the local operator. And I made enough money again fishing that I could afford to pay for the lessons.
What was your dad doing at this time?
Well, they hired couples. She was the teacher. He was the maintenance man.
Okay.
I mean, the school was totally self-contained.
So he didn't fly. This is
something you did entirely
on your own.
No, they had... So he maintained, we had the generator. It was the only gas engine in the whole village at that time.
So this is right after the war?
Yeah, 49, 50. 49.
And was anybody else flying at this time that you would have been inspired by or copied?
No, not really. It was the Jay's example showed me. And then the other thing was later on, I got to be 15, then 16, then 17. And there was no girls my age in the village. And I thought, well, I got to look around. And I heard there was a lot of pretty girls down in Chignik and whatever. So this is my side story.
Oh, that's good. So did you find any pretty girls?
I found one. I found Jenny in Chignik Lagoon. Married her. I was 18 when I got married. And we had 42 wonderful years. We had 8 children.
Wow. That's wonderful.
And anyway, I'd be flying back and forth to Chignik to court her, and somebody would walk up to me and say, I'll give you $30 if you'll take me with you. And I thought, hey, that's a pretty good deal. I'm going to do it anyway. Somebody's going to give me money. So that's basically what started Pin Air.
So what kind of plane? What was your first plane?
Well, the very first one was a Taylor craft, a two-seater, like that one out there, Jack Carton, the other one up.
Oh, yeah.
And for that first winter. But then the winter of 55, 50, the other thing was I'd be down in Chignik. Chignik had virtually no air service at all. Reeve had a goose base clear down at Cole Bay the other direction, and their schedule was once a week, and they made it maybe once every 3 weeks. So I would be there, and somebody would be sick or hurt, and they needed to get to the hospital. And the hospital was up in Dillingham, Conackenack. Mm-hmm. And so, they needed help. And yeah. I was there with my airplane. So I'd throw them in the airplane. It took me all day to get back up to Dillingham and take them to the hospital. I did that 4 or 5 times that first winter. And pretty soon the doctor in charge, George Wagner, called me aside and said, "Son," I was 19 by then, "son, if you'd get one of these commercial certificates, I got a budget, I can pay you for these trips." And that got me thinking too. So with all those factors, why, that's when I decided to go into business.
And what year did you found
March of 19, I actually started in 55, that's what we claim. But I got legal in March of 1956.
Okay, gotcha.
And then I graduated to a Piper Tri-Pacer. So I tripled my seating capacity.
So was there a special kind of, I guess the question I'm asking is, I was interviewing several pilots out in the Wrangells, and one of them had started in Bristol Bay, and he told me that the planes out there are very different because of the winds. So is that something that you had to consider?
Well, we had, not at first. But I realized that the advantages of a low wing airplane. I start with a Tri-Pacer, which is a high wing airplane, and we get a lot of wind out there. You
can't blow it over.
Yeah,
you need to have something stable.
And a low wing airplane like a Cherokee, so we transitioned to the Cherokees.
Gotcha. All right, so I want to switch directions a little bit here. We'll get back to the aviation story, but I do want to talk about some significant events that are associated with Bristol Bay. And if you have any memories or stories, please share. If you don't, no problem. I just want to get your perspective on some of these episodes that kind of help us with context. Mm-hmm. One, of course, is a biggie, is the Nova Rupta Katmai eruption in 1912.
Well, no, I don't know much about that, except what's written in the books. I've been up there, I've landed on the ash, and it's spectacular.
Are there any other stories, especially down in Pilot Point and Gashik, about volcanoes generally?
Well, I got one about Katmai, and that is, there was a village on the Pacific side, on the Shelikof Strait side, called Katmai, Native village. And when the mountain erupted, it spewed out all this ash, and they had to evacuate the village. So the Coast Guard sent a cutter in to pick up the people. There was, 80 or so, and move them down the coast to relocate the village. And they settled on Perryville. And the skipper's name was Captain Perry. So that's how Perryville got its name.
Yeah. And of course, Pilot Point, you have a few volcanoes.
We have Chiganagic.
Yeah.
Which is right out my living room window. It's beautiful.
All right, so the 1919 flu pandemic. Are there any lingering stories about the flu? I know Gashik Pilot Point got nailed by that.
Yes, all I have heard, I wasn't there. All I've heard was that Ugashik, particularly about Ugashik Village up the river from Pilot Point, was one of, if not the largest Native village in the whole Bristol Bay region. And they just basically got wiped out in the flu epidemic.
So you pretty much went to school with many of the survivors then?
Yes. The same families. A lot of them had Russian names from the Russian influence of the 1800s. When you fly around, there's actually three rivers that come into Ugashik Bay, the King Salmon, the Dog Salmon, and of course the Ugashik River itself. they have bluffs along the river, and every one of those bluffs, to this day even, you can still see the depressions where the Barabri houses were.
Yeah.
And there must have been there had to have been a lot of people living in that area.
Yeah. Yeah, it was an event that changed everything.
Yes.
So moving, the next year, of course, in World War One, the canneries were canning fish to feed the troops fighting in the trenches of France. And what happened in 1919 is that there was a combination of the flu pandemic and then the red salmon crash, because they overcaught in 14 and 15, and then by 19 the red salmon fishery crashed. Are there any stories about that?
No, I don't know anything about that. The only thing what I would know about after the turn of the century is the formation of Alaska Packers Association.
Right. So we'll get to that in a second.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to talk a little bit about Father Hubbert. He's another, we're kind of moving forward in time.
Yep.
We've gone move into the 1930s. What do you remember about Father Hubbert?
Well, just that as I grew up, I did hear stories from the old timers there about this priest and his float plane pilot from Fairbanks, which was Frank Dorban, spending the night at Pilot Point. They spent at least one night, maybe more, at Pilot Point to jump off to go into Aniakchak Crater, which is only 30 miles from Pilot Point, and land in that lake. It's a beautiful lake, Surprise Lake. I've been there many times. Some of the old timers remembered this priest that spent the night there.
Yeah, so that's a pretty historic event in kind of aviation history, is Father Hubbert landing in that, or he didn't, it was Dorbrandt who landed,
right.
And of course there's an account of that. Now as a pilot, how would you say that was how would you compare? Is it a pretty extraordinary aviation feat to land in that thing, in the
Not
plane
really.
That they had?
The lake is beautiful. It's like a mile and a half long.
Yeah.
And the crater is like 3 miles in diameter, so there's lots of room to operate the airplane once you get there. But the walls are like at least 2,000 feet high, and if there's any weather, you can't get over the walls, although there is the gates where the Aniakchak River runs out of the lake down to the Pacific side. And you can go through those gates, we call them. But it can be difficult to get in there.
Yeah, the story is they got blown out by the volcano.
Well,
and
the winds,
it had just the 31 eruption, I think.
No, I think that was formed long before that.
Oh, yeah, the event, but there were the little mini volcanoes that had formed.
Oh, yeah,
the
little
crater.
Cone.
Yeah.
There's a cone right alongside the lake. I've climbed to the top of it.
Wow.
About 400 feet high.
So, are there any other kind of historic events that are that have occurred that shape local perspective that you might?
I don't know.
No. All right, so let's move on then. Okay, Bristol Bay. How would you describe Bristol Bay from that bird's eye perspective?
You mean
from that air?
Geographically?
Yeah. Well, when you close your eyes and you're in that plane and you're flying over Bristol Bay, what do you see?
Well, of course, there's five river systems that comprise the Bristol Bay sockeye salmon fishery. And the key, a sockeye salmon has to have fresh water. They're different from the other salmon, most of them. So they need a freshwater lake, and usually this freshwater stream feeding the lake or along the lake shore. And it's well known now that each salmon goes back to exactly where it was hatched. And every year. So anyway, the key to the Bristol Bay salmon fishery is that there are so many freshwater lakes. Each one of those systems has its own freshwater lake. The Nooshiegak, has two systems. Quijac has Illiamna and Lake Clark, of course. Enactnic has Enactnic Lake and others. Igigig has Bashariff Lake, and at Ugashik we've got two upper and lower Ugashik lakes. And that is probably the largest acreage, square foot acreage, of fresh water in a compact location of anywhere in the world. And that's what drove the Bristol Bay salmon.
And of course, when the salmon came, so did the people who,
yep,
processors who came in to catch it and can it and send it to tables all over the world.
Yeah.
And that that's how you got, that's, they needed aviation.
Well, you want to talk about Alaska Packers?
Yeah, sure.
By the turn of the century, the late 1800s, people realized the value of the sockeye salmon. And they salt it, can it, or whatever. So on all these, not just Bristol Bay, but even down the chain further, individual operators built their own canneries, salmon canneries. And they would harvest the fish and can the fish and market them themselves. But they were all individuals. And then about 15 or 1920, the Del Monte Corporation thought that they would wanted to have a sockeye salmon, canned salmon, along the shelf alongside their vegetables and fruits. And so they got together and they bought up all these individual canneries and they formed Alaska Packers Association. What, 1920?
It was a little earlier, but yeah.
Okay. And so they operated these canneries. Where was I going?
Yeah. Well, APA started in the early 1890s.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I wasn't around then.
But yeah, no, and so they have all these canneries, and...
Oh, yeah, and so to support the canneries, Del Monte is in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
To support the canneries, they assembled a fleet of, 80 or so? Four-masted sailing ships. And they based them in Alameda across the bay from San Francisco.
Oakland, right.
And every spring they would, I guess the days of the steamship,
right,
was coming along, the iron ships, and these wooden vessels weren't worth much anyway, so they were able to buy them and assemble them. And every spring they would load up this fleet. And being in San Francisco, they would get Chinamen from Chinatown, they would get the Italians from North Beach to be fishermen, and the Chinamen canned the salmon, and then they would load all the tin and the cartons and salt and sail to Bristol Bay.
Yeah.
And each ship would go, sometimes two or three ships probably to NN. And the Italians would go fishing, and the Chinamen would run the cannery. They'd spend 6 weeks producing the fish, and then they would load all the canned salmon back and the guys back and sail back to San Francisco every fall. But the thing is, so those ships laid there for this month or two, couple of months, while the fish was being caught and processed. And there was a crew of 10 or 12 guys, at least, on each ship. They had nothing to do, waiting for the fish to be processed. So they would go ashore and mingle. And lo and behold, a lot of the sailors found local girls in the village and married them. And that's why there's so much Caucasian influence in,
sure,
Bristol Bay.
Yeah, well, quite, it's a Scandinavian, and yeah.
Scandinavians.
Yeah. So, you talked about the transportation northward with the sailing ships, and when did aviation become part of that story?
Well, I suppose there was planes flying in as early as the 1920s, or 1930s actually. Dorbat being, mm-hmm, one of the first ones to go and take Father Hubbard, that was 35. And then There was some operators started in Dillingham and Naknek.
And the military base out there by
then
too.
Then the war came, yes, when the war came along, they built King Salman Air Force Base.
Yep.
And so that created a lot more activity.
So when you were serving the canneries, what did that mean? What did you do? How did you serve the canneries? What were you providing?
Well, they had to have all the workers flown in and flown out because it was seasonal.
Right.
And nobody lived there. They just went there to work. So they had to be flown in and be flown out.
Yeah.
And that's what I was able to take advantage of.
Did you bring groceries and things like that in?
Fresh produce, I guess, and breakdown parts for to keep the cannery going. But the main thing was the people.
Right.
All the stuff came in on boats, the major supplies.
So when you started Pan Air, right, it's one thing to have an airplane, you got to land somewhere, right? So where were you landing?
Oh, there was no runways.
Oh, okay.
So I had to learn to land on the beach. And the most important document I had to have in my possession when I was flying was a tide book. Because you can't land on a beach when the tide is high.
Right, and you're talking about some historic tides, right? Some of the biggest.
Well, in Bristol Bay it is.
Yeah.
But on the other side, Pacific side, there are only about 10-foot tides. But still, they're substantial.
Yeah.
And Chignik Bay, there was no runways anywhere. Perryville had a terrible beach, very soft sand and dunes and stuff. Had to be careful there. But I had to land on the beaches. Until the early 60s, I realized I needed to have a seaplane so I could land, particularly at Chignik Bay, because the Alaska Packers cannery took, a couple hundred people to operate that cannery in the summer, and they all had to fly in, they all had to fly out, plus the in and outs of medical reasons, whatever reason, all summer long. So
you landed right there in the bay.
So I got my widgeon, and I was able to land in the bay and put the wheels down and taxi up on the beach and park,
mm-hmm.
and then take off. A straight float plane wouldn't work there because of the tides. If you have a float plane and you pull up on a beach, the tide's either coming in or going out. Either way, you gotta stay with the airplane.
Yeah.
But with a Grumman, I could just put the wheels down, taxi up on the beach and park.
It's an amazing plane. So let's talk a little bit about King Salman. How did you get started up there?
Well, because that was the transportation hub.
With the military?
For commercial connections to Anchorage and the outside world. Pacific Northern operated and Northern Consolidated.
Oh,
operated.
Okay. Yep.
And they both started with DC-3s. We flew into King Salman with a DC-3 in 1949 at Pacific Northern. But that was it. They went into the Air Force base, the Army base, I guess it was then. But there was no way to get to the villages. And that's where us small planes came in. So that was the hub. And I needed a contact there for people coming and going to and from Anchorage and beyond. So I bought an operation in 1965 for Peninsula Airways to operate and connect from the villages to the airline services.
Did you work with George at that time, Tibbetts?
Oh, well, okay. Tibbetts started, him and Julius Harry started at Tibbetts Harry Airmotive long before I did. They were like 49. They were there in the military, at least George was. And he met a local gal, married her, decided to settle down there and learn to fly. And so they provided the local service around the Naknek-Dillingham area, and particularly Alaska Packers. George was practically the only mode of transportation they would use. Both South Naknek and Igigig were the two primary ones, and over Clark's Point. So, see, he was well established, and he had all that business. But I grew up going to Chignik, and Chignik had a pretty substantial cannery too, just one, but it was a lot. So I got all that work because George didn't like to fly that far. So I did all the Chignik business, and he did all the local Natnik business. And I thought, you know, we ought to get together and put it all into one pot. So that's what we did in 1969. Tibbetts became part of Pin Air.
Okay.
George was our vice president. And Georgie to this day. Well, he recently finally quit flying, I think.
Well, my very first memory of flying to, well, going to Alaska, of course, was in an airplane, and it was George Sr., and he had his cigar unlit, but it was in his mouth, and I was four, and I remember was writing, and I was like, he's not flying, you know, I couldn't understand that, and he turned around, and he talked to me, and we landed at the strip above the cannery there. And we got out, and he handed me $50. That is my very first memory of landing. And I thought, well, heck, that's great. Every pilot should give a kid $50.
And of course, each cannery was basically its own little village.
Yeah.
They were self-contained.
Yeah.
Carpenter shop, mess hall, bunkhouse, everything. And their own airstrip. Each cannery had its own little airstrip.
And that's important. That really signifies the importance of aviation to the canneries, because every cannery built an airstrip.
Because there was no road access at all. Mm-hmm. Very limited boat access. It was very unfeasible. So the airplane was what supported those canneries.
Yeah, when you think that tide goes out, you know, twice a day, it's, you know, you could almost walk across.
So yes, each cannery basically built its own airstrip.
Yeah.
And then had its own airstrip. That's where that picture was taken.
Yep. Do you have any memory of when that strip was built?
No, it was before my time. Because it was already there when I started flying in the mid-50s.
Oh, it was already there.
Huh? Yeah.
Interesting.
So, yeah, it was at least three airstrips on the south side of the river.
Yeah, do you remember when the main South Naknek airport or airstrip was built?
Oh, that was only about 20 years ago, maybe.
Well, about 20 years ago they added the cross.
Yeah, well, maybe it was built before that. But Peter Pan had its own strip up at Millinac. NN had its own strip. Columbia Wards had its own airstrip at Bumblebee.
Mm-hmm.
So there was three of them on the south side.
Yeah, that just speaks to the importance of aviation.
Yes, Peter, on the other side, Peterson Point had its own airstrip. Diamond J up at Quijac had its own airstrip.
Yeah.
And that's how we supported the canneries.
Yep. So really quickly, I want to talk about spotting, fish spotting. What is that? And did you ever do it?
No. Because the salmon, Bristol Bay is almost all muddy, real muddy water, and you can't see them anyway. So that spotting is more like herring over in the Togiak side in the springtime. I never did that.
Yeah, they used to do it, though, in Bristol Bay, didn't they?
Not for salmon.
They tell two planes crashed, and that was,
Boy, I don't know, Katie. I don't...
You don't remember?
You can't spot salmon in Bristol Bay.
Yeah, it would be.
I never did it.
Yeah. Well, I imagine it's very, very dangerous.
Yes, I've lost two good friends over in Togiak, herring spotting.
Yeah. Okay, so let's change gears one last time. You doing okay?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's talk about the cannery history. We talked a little bit about the airstrip. And of course the photo with, and we'll post this too, we'll make sure it's there, with Norm Rockness, the superintendent, picture taken in You said 1964?
No, July of 1962.
62.
And I was Don Cooper was the Alaska superintendent, or the Alaska VP in charge of Bristol. I mean, he was the man, the big shot that Del Monte appointed to run Bristol Bay. And he was actually, I think his main office was in Seattle, but he would go up particularly during the fishing season and make trips around to the various canneries. And again, the Tibbetts side did all the local transportation, South Naknek, Iggy, and even as far as Pilot Point, Clark's Point. But Chignik was mine. I was the only one that flew to Chignik. And so that particular day, I was taking Don Cooper and a guy named Harlan Shane. Harlan was the director of quality control for Alaska. And they were going to Chignik to make their inspection trip, or whatever.
So do you remember other people who were working at South Naknek at that time? There was Norm Rockness, of course. What do you remember about him?
Oh, Norm was quite a guy. He actually was the superintendent down at Iggy to start with. That's when I first met him.
Okay.
For several years at Iggy. Then he got promoted and moved up to South Naknek. And he was quite a very strong man and a very good superintendent. He ran a tight ship. And did Gary come after, right after Norm, or was
well,
there
somebody
else?
Well, there was Tom Takioka who replaced Norm Mountney after he passed away.
Yeah.
And then he was there 1 year, and Dad came in as the storekeeper, and he was also down at Pilot Point. Did you know Dad when he was at Pilot Point?
Barely. Yes, yeah. I do know he was at Pilot Point.
And then he was at Iggy Gick.
Yeah.
And then he managed the store, and then worked his way to bookkeeper, and then eventually assistant superintendent under Takioka, and then became superintendent.
I remember Tom being, he had something to do with quality control too.
Yeah.
Before he became, I forgot about him being superintendent.
Yeah, I think it was just 1 year.
And then before that, there was, I think somebody else. But
Hank Bison, I think.
Oh, Hank Bison, yeah. But the name that really strikes out is Frank Phillips.
Phillips, yeah. A lot of people talk about him.
Well, of course, every cannery had its superintendent's private quarters, a house, and they were usually painted white, so they were called the White House. Every cannery had its White House, where the superintendent lived. And Frank Phillips was noted for his extravagant habits.
He
would hold fantastic dinners, candlelight dinners, with steaks and baked potatoes, the whole nine yards, and invite guests, particularly when somebody was visiting, like Don Cooper. And white linen tablecloths.
At the White House there?
At the White House, yeah.
And I remember that building. It's all still there.
It's still there, right?
Yeah. In fact, what I find really interesting is there's quite a bit of Japanese figurines, and I'm wondering if that would have been gifts that Japanese buyers or would have
been buyers, exactly, yes.
When they were doing these
because the workers that were the Oriental workers were all Chinese,
Filipinos,
yeah.
You know, actually, this is a surprising thing. Talking about the workers, would it surprise you if I told you that the biggest number of of ethnicities who worked at the cannery, you know what that was? Mexicans.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
No, it would surprise me.
I
didn't see that in Pilot Point.
No, I think that my theory is you had Del Monte, Central California area, and they did a big rebuild of the cannery in the 1940s during the war, and which is actually where most of the buildings were built today. And I think what they did is they brought up people who are probably working in the picking vegetables and fruit for the you know, CalPAC, and I think they probably brought people up to help do the construction and the.
That makes sense. I hadn't thought about it.
Yeah, I don't have the historic ground truth yet, but that's my theory, and it makes a lot of sense.
It does make a lot of sense.
And
what's
interesting is, you know, with the area that they call the Chinese bunkhouses.
Yep.
In the reports, the APA reports, they refer to them as the Mexican bunkhouses. So they were definitely there. They were prevalent, but they have since kind of disappeared in memory.
We've still got Chinatown in Pilot Point. I think the buildings is actually gone now, but yeah, we had our own Chinatown.
Yeah, and I think that's important because we still remember that there were, you know, the Chinese processors and workers, and now we know their importance and role because of the names, the location, but because the Mexican workers, those buildings didn't hold the names. They've been kind of erased from that local memory.
Interesting.
Yeah, I find that fascinating too. So, do you remember? You remember, of course, Bison, Frank Phillips, Norm Rockness, Tom Takioka, and then
Gary.
What do you remember about him?
He was kind of laid back, kind of quiet, you know, but he was very, very smart and ran a very tight ship, and I think he was a great superintendent.
Yeah. Trefon Agnesen remembers him as the superintendent in tennis shoes.
Yeah, I can picture that.
That there was kind of he represented perhaps a change or a different type of superintendent.
Oh, totally different than Norm Rockness.
How so?
Well, just that Norm was very assertive, and he made no bones about throwing orders around and how he felt. And your dad was more laid back, and he would speak softly but carry a big stick.
So, what I have always been curious about, the fairly recent, the main South Naknek airstrip, there's graves out there, Japanese graves. Do you have any recollection of those?
No, I didn't have any idea.
Yeah, okay. So, do you want to take a little break? Are you okay?
Well, no, I...
Okay, you good?
I'll probably be getting a phone call here pretty quick.
Okay, well, we will then move on. So, South Naknek, NN Cannery. How many times do you think you've flown into that cannery?
How many thousand can you count?
Any thousands of times.
Not as many as Tibbetts.
And what would be the reason for flying into that cannery? Again, seasonal workers, and that was primarily the main reason?
Yeah, exactly. But of course, I think in those days, that was the closest runway to the main village, meaning the post office.
Oh.
So we would fly so that was year round, we'd fly the mail in there.
Mail in.
And then we used that airstrip.
Okay. And there was a hospital at that cannery. There was a hospital there that served all through the Spanish flu pandemic, and it was there was a doctor there right up until they turned it into a women's bunkhouse in the 80s. No reason to, you didn't fly people in there.
And each cannery, of course, usually had its own doctor.
Right.
But just for the season.
Yeah.
And once the season was over, they...
Right. But there you didn't fly anybody there for any sort, because I know they had a full
if I had medical people from down the chain, they'd go to Dillingham.
Kamakanak. Okay. And what do you...
Then the NACNIC clinic started later on.
Yeah. Right. And what do you remember about the cannery? When you flew in, did you stay or did you just immediately, did you have a...
No, I usually didn't stay. I'd just fly in and out. But sometimes I'd have these VIPs from other companies that were wanting to look at the cannery and learn about it. And, of course, they wanted me to wait. And they just spend a couple hours and then go move on. So I would go along with them through the cannery. And that machinery operation was pretty amazing.
Yeah.
The iron chinks.
Yeah. So what do you remember about that cannery? What sticks into your mind?
Just all the activity, and of course that was what, about a 5-line cannery?
At one time, yeah.
Yeah, and 5 lines all going with iron chinks and workers preparing the fish, processing it, putting it in the cans, putting it in the retorts, and taking it out in coolers. The whole process is pretty interesting.
It was one of the bigger canneries.
Yes, that was one of the biggest ones, I think. Maybe King Cole, Peter Pan had King Cole. But NN was one of the biggest canneries in the state.
What about the mess hall? Did you go ever have dinner there?
I don't know. Maybe, probably lunch. Yeah, well, I had lunches there. Yeah. Rockness would take me into the Blue Room.
The Blue Room, yeah. Right. And the Blue Room was separate from
an elite place where only the big shots could eat.
Now, one of the things we're going to do is name our exhibit, title it, Mug Up. When I say that word, what does that mean to you?
It means 10 o'clock in the morning and 3 o'clock in the afternoon. We'd go down and have a cup of coffee or chocolate or donuts or whatever.
Yeah, those coffee breaks.
Yeah, coffee break. When I was a kid, that was, to me, that was really something to be able to go down to and have a cup of chocolate with the men and the workers. That was pretty cool.
So do you remember any of the other kind of seasonal workers and laborers, like Filipino bosses or any of those kind of stories about
them? Not really. Of course, the fishermen were mostly Italians.
Italians, a few Scandinavians.
A few Scandinavians.
Yeah.
And I was just a kid, and that was in the sailboat days.
Yeah.
I got to fish the last year that we used straight sailboats.
Yeah.
1950, 51, I guess. Is when they started allowing power on their boats. And that was interesting.
Yeah, how so?
Just it was a different way of life, and we would put the net out and drift, and then pull the net in and sail to the scow where we could unload the fish. And if the tide was wrong, they had what we call monkey boats,
right?
The little tugboats that would tow us sailboats up against the tide. And so we could deliver our fish. And then, when we quit fishing, where this mast was in a sail, there's a little forecastle. This is a 28-foot double-ender sailboat. And there was a little space up under that bow where we could put out our sleeping bags and sleep. But the mast was in the way. So the sail had to come down. And then we could put the tent up, and then we could camp for the night.
Right. Now, I just want to talk about one other area, last area of the importance of aviation to the fishery. And that occurs, of course, after statehood, I'm thinking, with fish and game and the management of the fishery, which oftentimes gets left out. You know, we talk about the fishermen, we talk about the canneries, but often in that kind of trifecta is the story of managing that fishery and how the biologists were, you know, keeping index and counting, and aviation plays a role in that, doesn't
it? That's good, because that was a significant part of my business, was doing particularly stream surveys.
Mm-hmm.
And you talk about spotting fish. Yeah. Well, we didn't spot fish out in the ocean. We did the stream surveys where we'd fly the biologists and they'd count the fish, and we had to follow the stream at about 100 feet.
So did you have cameras attached to the plane, or how did they do that?
No, he had a tallywhacker.
Oh, okay.
And he would physically count the fish, looking at them. And in fact, their system was, salmon were big schools in these little creeks. So I think the technique I was told by one of the biologists was to count 10 fish, determine how big an area that was, and then use that to determine approximately how many fish.
Yeah.
And so, they had to determine the escapement in every stream as to how they managed the fishery. And we were an important part of that in that we flew the biologists up the streams to count the fish. And so they could manage the fishery. And then there was the enforcement part of it, too.
Right, which that plane right out in front there, wasn't that used for?
The goose.
The goose, right?
Yeah. Well, that was more of a, that was a federal.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, wasn't it?
Yes, Fish and Wildlife Service would fly over and they would spot a boat. This is more, anyway, Bristol Bay or the other side. Fishing illegally over the line.
Right.
And identify them and sight them. And I did some of that, but I had to be careful because here's all my customers, the canneries, with their fishermen and their employees. And if I fly over and identify them and they're turned in and sighted, it didn't make the cannery happy.
Right.
So I was pretty careful. I had to be, well, I learned the hard way because I actually did that down in the Chigney side.
Yeah, to serve a lot of different interests, it sounds like.
Well, I would take a buck from anybody that would pay me, right? Whether it was a fisherman or whether it was the government. I don't care. Their money was all the same. So I had to be careful about that.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I found when I did my aviation study is you can still live, you know, quote unquote, remotely, but aviation gave people not just a physical connection, but also a psychological connection.
I think so.
Do you think?
Yes, absolutely. And remember, in the before the 1970s, actually, there was no phones. Everything was, we had all had two-way radios in our houses, in our living rooms, and I had in my airplane to talk to the customers. Our phones didn't come along until 74, I think, when the satellites started.
Some ways we were more connected in those days because you really were dependent on...
And of course, when you're talking on a two-way radio, everybody in the country is listening.
Yeah, right. That's right. Yeah, no one's business is too private in those days, huh? Well,
and each cannery had its own two-way radio, and that was our communications.
Well, and I imagine that's where you really see that connection. I mean, the airstrips and the airplanes really did connect the community and the canneries. I mean, they
absolutely,
were,
yes.
So what would you, you know, I think what's important isn't just from the cannery perspective, but also from the community perspective. How important were the canneries to the local community and vice versa? How important were the local community to the canneries?
Well, of course, the canneries did use some local labor, but most of them were out fishing. And so that's why they had to import all the workers to the canneries. But the cannery was everything to the community because that's the source of revenue for everybody, whether they were fishing or not so much working in the cannery, but it was a very important way to sustain those communities. That's why we have such better economics in Bristol Bay than, say, up in the Yukon or Kuskokwim. Yeah.
So, just a few final thoughts here. Kind of looking back now, how old are you?
I'm now 82.
82.
Yeah.
And you started back when you were 14, 15 years old.
Yeah, got serious at about 17.
So, looking back on this long career, what would you say are your biggest successes?
Still being alive.
That's a good success. Absolutely. Anything else?
No.
I mean, that you're really...
Because flying is all I know, and that's all I've done, and that's all I care about.
Any regrets?
No, no regrets.
No regrets.
Read the title of my book.
That's right. You breathe,
I fly.
That's right.
It's all I know and it's all I've done.
So what advice would you give us? What do you think are some of the most important things that we really need to inform a public that may not know anything about what what you know, these experiences, you know, accumulate to, or you know, what are the things that you think we need to inform that visiting public about in our mug up exhibit?
I don't know, Katie. I think you're way ahead of me.
I can just kind of interpret the history, and like you said, you've lived it, you breathe it.
Well, you're doing a great job, and I appreciate what you guys are doing.
Well, thank you.
I just think it's important to preserve that history, and it's what helped build Alaska.
Absolutely. Well, we will make sure that Aviation Strip is on the National Register nomination, because it played an absolutely crucial role, and we want to thank you so much for your contribution and your stories. And if there's anything you want to, last final thoughts, otherwise.
No, I just appreciate the work you guys are doing.
Well, thank you very much, Warren.
Okay.
Thank you.
Got it.
Okay, I'm totally inspired by being here and getting to see all the wonderful exhibits here in the Aviation Museum. And if I can get my way, and we get a couple of the gas boxes that we found the cannery workers have repurposed as furniture, what can you tell me that would help us describe those appropriately in the exhibit?
Well, first of all, when we started flying, of course, there was no gas stations. So Chevron manufactured furnished fuel for us in 2 5-gallon cans, 2 5-gallon square cans, and they built a wooden box to surround the can. And 2 5-gallon cans just fit each box, and they would ship the boxes all over Naknek, our store in Pilot Point. And we'd buy the boxes of gas, and then we'd gas up our plane. And the cans are kind of one thing, but the boxes were very useful, and we used them for shelving in our houses. And then of course then we had the 50-gallon barrels of gas, the boxes were part of our life.
Were those for sale at the cannery store? Is that where you
Yes.
go buy them?
Yes. Yeah, they would ship it in on boats along with all the canned goods and groceries and stock the store.
So you were a customer at the cannery store?
Yep. Buy them at the store.
And then food? You'd store
canned goods?
Provisions?
Yes.
There.
Which would all be shipped in every summer. And they'd stock the store enough for... And most of us had our own orders from wherever in Seattle. And our whole winter's provisions would be loaded on the ship in Seattle and barged up, brought up to probably Naknek, and then transported on the cannery scows to the village. And that's how we lived.
Did you guys do much with the reindeer? They didn't.
No, I never got involved with reindeer.
Yeah,
I do know. Oh, okay. I do know that Pilot Point is the only village south of clear up to Bethel, I think, that has a separate little side community of Eskimos. And that was done in the 1920s, I believe, or maybe a little earlier even. The government used the Coast Guard to get a whole bunch of reindeer up around the Nome or Kotzebue area and bring them down to Bristol Bay. It's supposed to be a way to help feed the people, I guess. And they used the Eskimo herders mm-hmm. that were up there. And there was a lot of fencing built, which you can't see any of it anymore, but I used to see the wooden fences they built for miles and miles, corrals.
Wow. Yeah.
And to keep the reindeer. This is in the Pilot Point, Port Hyden area.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a group of Eskimos that settled in Pilot Point, and they settled about a mile away from the main village. We still call it Eskimo Town to this day, because the Eskimos and the Aleuts didn't get along that well together. But Pilot Point has the only settlement of Eskimos.
Mm-hmm.
But that was from those days of the reindeer. I'd forgotten about
yeah.
that.
Yeah, there was a corral up in Katmai too, or up on the near Lake Naknek Lake.
And oh, okay.
I have some photos of that.
Oh.
And they were moving reindeer by aviation, so I was curious if
yeah.
they would.
I didn't know about that.
Very cool.
Okay.
Well, excellent.
Thank you.
Well, this has been interesting, actually. Thank you. Thank you guys for your efforts. I think it's important to preserve this history.
I do too.
Just like our aviation history.
Well, I think, I know my dad, he had a hard time with this, to be honest with you, because he left and, not under his own, it was
yeah.
with the accident. And,
I understand.
And he never, and he actually did go back once for Carville Zimmons Sr.'s funeral, and it was really hard on him,
yeah.
really hard. And he didn't want to have anything to do with this. And I, started this project and I think now he's finally, he's okay, because I think what he's seen is, it doesn't have to be the end. I think what happens is sometimes, 129 years is a long time and,
yeah.
Eventually everything comes to an end. But what's wonderful with what we're, I think what we're doing and seeing is that what we're creating is something new, from the end of this cannery. And if we can and do something that gives the communities a new direction or a new something, to think about, then that's a pretty cool thing.
Well, more power to you, both of you.
Well, thank you. And yes, that airstrip will definitely be on the National Register.
So are you going to do anything on salad, Sam?
I am actually, if you can think of anybody who might have some photos of Salad Sam throughout the peninsula, I want to put together a gallery on my touch screen at the King Salmon Visitor Center. And I've got a very few, I think five, that he has.
Boy, I sure can't think of any offhand, but I'll think about that. But that was really neat for him to come with that beaver to each village and selling vegetables out of his airplane.
Oh, yeah, it was a big deal for me, too. We got to get out of school. That was the best part. We made a dollar.
So who was Salad Sam?
Salad Sam is my dad.
Her father.
That's
Sam.
Your dad.
Sam Agley.
And who was...
That's how he started.
Yeah.
He started with a fixed wing. He had a beaver, and he would fly around. And I thought he was crazy. How the hell? How the hell can you make money flying an expensive plane like a beaver?
Big and slow.
And big and slow.
Yeah, they fly like 20 miles.
And for selling groceries.
Yeah.
Selling fresh produce is
yeah.
what it was. That's why we call him Salad Sam.
That's great. I didn't
yeah.
know that they
and
called him.
Nicknames. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, and it's amazing to me, as I get, since returning home and getting out to some of these villages, the recognition I have of these airstrips and these beach landing locations, because, I grew up landing in all these places.
Yeah.
As I go to conferences and am reintroduced to people from around the region, I have to go, wait a minute, where do I know you from? Put it together, I've learned to ask, what village are you from?
Yeah.
And quite often, we probably played together, and
yeah.
memory is
yeah.
still there.
Right.
I'll ask my daughter, Susie. She still has a house in Pilot Point. She still lives there.
How come Pan Air didn't get into like the helicopter business where they would fly
to
the processors?
I didn't trust helicopters.
Yeah, the whole processor scene and the support. Because that's, I remember Lambert, do you know a fellow named Lambert? He used to fly for, I think it was ERA in those days, off Unicy. He would fly, I remember, he flew the processors. And
Bundren had his own helicopter
yeah.
pilot, Tim.
Yeah, Tim, I remember him.
Yeah, mm-hmm. But no, I never liked them.
Yeah.
And they were very expensive.
Yeah.
And I didn't see how anybody could make any money with them.
Yeah.
But... your dad gave us a ride when he tried hooking up with that hotel downtown.
Yeah.
that one winter. That guy's, that's another story. But but Sam tried to help him, and had it based on the rooftop of the Holiday Inn down there. I still call it Holiday Inn. And he gave us a ride one winter, 4 or 5 years ago. And that was scary. To be in a
helicopter.
I've only been in a helicopter, but I trust Sam totally. But I've only been in a helicopter 3-4 times my whole life.
Huh. That's interesting.
It feels different.
Yeah, it does. Really, I've been in there once.